So just hit record. So we have, there's some conflicts today. I was saying a delayed opening in Madison, maybe just for the high school. There was a borough, something with the borough in Madison, a meeting that John Hooper had to attend. Glenn was doing something for Chatham Borough Council as well. So that's okay. I don't have a ton to go over today. I want to talk about where we are with the grant application and just, you know, we can have a conversation about our meetings going forward. I think this might be, hopefully, fingers crossed, this is going to be our last virtual meeting. So I want to talk a little bit about our structure moving forward as we come back in person and what April might look like. excuse me. So I'll start with sectors. If anyone has anything that they want to share from their particular sector, anything, Heather, that going on in the schools, or maybe a recap of Audra's presentation, anything that you want to share?
Sure. So we had Audra Tenero present to parents in the community about preparing their kids for a successful transition to college. So she talked about beyond like the academic side of college, how to prepare students about peer pressure, substance use, being safe at school, as well as all the resources that are there, checking in on their mental health, the importance of calling your kids when they're at college and just staying connected with them and seeing what's going on. So the parents seem to be really engaged in that conversation, and she shared a lot of really great information. As far as what's going on in the schools right now, not a ton of programming. We're kind of swamped with like individual counseling at the moment. But we do have another consortium event for parents on March 23rd. It'll be at Milburn High School. But parents from the Chatham community will be invited to attend. And that's gonna be on current drug trends and what the kids are using, how parents can kind of talk to them about it, and what signs and symptoms they can look for. And that's by Jamie Carvalho. I don't know exactly how to say her last name, but she's done a lot of presentations for us, and she's really knowledgeable and great.
Thanks, Heather. And some of you might remember Jamie Carvalho was a speaker on a panel for the Coalition and the Alliance back in 2018, maybe. At Chatham Middle School. So she's really great. She was kind of one of the first people that we talked to about vaping back in early 2018. And she shed a lot of light as it was sort of an emerging trend at that point. She was a great link between the Coalition and Summit Behavioral Health when she was there. Heather, if you want to share that flyer, we'll include it in the newsletter this week and next week as well, because you said the 23rd.
Awesome.
So great. Thank you. Anybody have anything else that they want to share from their sector? Stacey Ewald is joining us right now. Go ahead,
let me just give a little background on my question about teens in the library access, because last night the library of the Chatham made a presentation to the borough council. They did their annual presentation update and everything, but one of the things they would like to do is to hire an additional staff person, a staff person that would be dedicated to both technology and teens. And I thought that is such a fantastic idea, because remembering my years in New York City public schools, the libraries always, the major libraries always had a separate area for teens and actually had programming for teens. And so I spoke at the council meeting saying that I'm a member of this coalition and that one of the things we feel that we've noticed is that there are just aren't enough activities for adolescents, particularly middle school and high school students that draw them into they give them an opportunity to be self-reflective and to and so that having a dedicated staff member that would just address teen issues at the libraries, I think would be a fantastic idea. They were asking for a salary of $32,000 something for this individual. I was concerned. I think they should be asking for a higher salary in order to get somebody who could really be a partner. And I was thinking that that would be another great segment partner if we can get, you know, if that goes through. And so that's why I was asking if Madison Library has anybody on staff dedicated to adolescent issues, teen issues, particularly with all this insanity going on around the country about banning books. And many of these books that they're talking about banning are books that adolescents really need to be processed, to be understanding and processing. So I think having dedicated staff people in the libraries, in the public libraries, that are concerned about adolescent issues can also, develop some programming outside of the schools so that we touch base on a variety of areas of their lives with these young people, not just in school, in their schools and their religious organizations, but also in libraries, which are public, which are public service organizations also. End of spiel.
So Rosella, what's happening with the library specifically? They're creating a teen space or teen center in the Chatham Library, or is it going to be in another location in Chatham?
No, but they are doing a place to space program where they're reorganizing the space. They're not changing the footprint of the building necessarily, but they're reorganizing the space and they want to set up a space that's dedicated just for adolescents. Right now they have two computers sitting in a hallway, which is basically the area that, and they have some, of course they have some reading materials, but they don't have somebody that's organizing structured programs for them. And that's what they were asking for funding for. So it certainly isn't in place. It is a request that I certainly advocated for. And I think that, but I think that it's a meaningful request. And I think that it's a meaningful strategy. We look at what's going on in Chatham. There is nothing really in Chatham for, to bring young people together. We have that climbing, wall climbing place. But other than that, we just ignore our adolescents. We send them to school, process them through school, and they go off to college and they don't develop tremendous community roots as a result of the lack of attention to their interests and their needs.
I remember a couple of years ago, Madison Library had pretty robust teen after school program that they were running. They were offering different workshops for different gaming systems, and it was pretty popular. But I don't know if they had hired, if somebody was specific to that programming, somebody on staff, or how exactly they were working that. And I don't know, what the makeup is right now of the offerings that they have. But I remember that it was popular a couple of years ago. So,
And necessary. Yeah. So I certainly think that anything we can do as an organization to encourage and to nurture this kind of development, I think would be really, really meaningful, particularly when we're talking about middle school kids. They go and hang out in places. Well, yeah, they should hang out and they should socialize with friends, but there have to be healthy places for them to do it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And, there's the teen center here at the Y. and, I think just remembering, when I was working in that department, it's a lot of Madison kids because it's so accessible from Madison Junior School after school for them to walk here. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, you know, it's just not as easy for Chatham kids. So, but with teen scene programming on Friday nights, we, you know, there were many more Chatham teens that were coming to that program than after school. So is Kathy, is teen scene running right now? Is the teen center open after school right now? Oh, you're muted, Kathy.
Yeah, right now it's open, but for specific programming, it's not open as the as a drop-in yet. But that will be coming. But yeah, definitely for specific programming that, you know, or whatever teen programs we have going on, we utilize the teen center. Yeah, yeah. But it will be back up and running soon.
Good. It's so interesting too, like with this grant in particular, the grant that we have. You know, we're supposed to provide support. That's one of our seven strategies to affect community change, which is great. And, you know, we do that through offering, you know, the Teen Task Force and offering those opportunities. We partnered with the Teen Center at the Y in the past on their Teen Scene program. But one of the things that we cannot spend funding on is transportation, which is unfortunate because, you know, it's an access issue. Especially for, you know, kids in Chatham, they can't get here, and they would be able to if there was transportation available. So it's just, it's one of those things that's a bummer. And it's not, I don't want to say it's obscure, but the other things that, you know, are hard nosed are lighting, food, you know, things like that, you know, that we're clearly not allowed to, those are unallowable costs. But the transportation has always bothered me a little bit because in this particular area, but then you think about also really, really rural areas where, you know, you could see how a coalition could potentially spend a lot of money, a lot of the grant money on transportation. So I can understand why those restrictions are in place. But it'll be interesting to see what the library does and to see kind of what their offerings are. And yeah, I agree with you, Rosella. I think it could be a really great opportunity for collaboration with MCC and the alliances as well. So thank you for sharing that.
Another question, a quick sure. question to Kathy. Do kids come to the Y with on their own bicycles, or are they pretty much dependent upon somebody driving them?
I think a lot of, I mean, I don't really quite know the answer to that question specifically. I don't see a lot of bicycles. I haven't in the past. Allison can probably talk to that more because she used to work in that program. But I would say it's either walking or, you know, being dropped off.
Yeah. I'd say 4 years ago, it was a lot of bicycles after school. But I think also, things have shifted a little. Well, obviously things have shifted majorly, but the emphasis on athletics and kids also want to, and even 4 years ago with teen scene programming, they want to come to the Y because they want to work out or they want to play basketball a lot of times. So they, you know, if their parents are coming to work out, they'll get a ride with their parents and, you know, they'll just stay and want to work out instead of maybe being in the teen center, playing a game or playing a computer game or, you know, PlayStation or whatever. And sports, so many kids are involved in sports. A lot of times the kids that we were seeing, in the teen center were not playing sports, did not have that commitment after school. So the teen center kind of filled that void, which was great. It was so important, you know, it still is, just to be a space for them. So I would say, 4 years ago, there were a lot of kids that were riding bikes. And this was like one of their stops. They would go to Walgreens, they would go here, they would go someplace else, kind of on their little tour of Madison.
I can tell you that as far as teens in the facility and working out, there's been a huge increase. I mean, if you come here any day between, you know, 2:30 and 5 o'clock, our new Glasser Center and the fitness center is filled with teens, you know, high school kids.
Yeah. so, and it'll also, as Teen Scene and Teen Center programming starts ramping up again, I think it's going to be another great opportunity, you know, for to talk about different collaboration efforts between MCC and the Y and the junior school and the middle school and all these groups that we kind of haven't really been able to do too much with over the past 2 years. So, yeah.
But I think that 2 years is a big time to break and build habits, and that there has to be intentional outreach particularly in the middle school areas to inform and encourage young people to come in and participate again.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. It's kind of interesting. I mean, we're in the middle of a school year too. So it's kind of an interesting time to start these efforts up, but, you know, going into the summer and starting healthy habits in the summer, you know, it's important timing wise as well. So anybody else have anything? Stacey, sorry, I know you just left and then rejoined. Do you have anything that you want in your, there you go. Anything that you want to add from Chatham Township Committee? Any updates?
Sorry, was that for me?
Yes, I was, sorry to put you on the spot.
I was mid switching devices. no, I have no updates. I caught most of what Rosella said and just agree that all those efforts for the library are worthwhile. Rosella, did they approve the additional budget?
The budget is being presented on April 11th.
Okay.
Okay, if anybody, there isn't anything else, I'll just move us on to kind of where we are in the continuation application and kind of what that process has been like. And then I'll talk a little bit about a couple of updates, and then we'll talk about our meeting schedule moving forward. So we're in the thick of it with the with the grant writing for sure. So I can't remember, yes, when we met in February, I think the notice of funding opportunity had just been released. So we are, I'd say, about two-thirds of the way through writing the project narrative. So just to give kind of an overview of what the package looks like, I think it's important for everyone just to kind of have an understanding of the different components and how different sectors have played a really big part in helping this all come together. So there's two major components to the application. There are the statutory eligibility requirements, and then there's the project narrative. I'll talk about the project narrative first. That is that's 20 pages of basically our case for why we are deserving of this grant and why our community needs this grant. Just a couple of things. We are applying for a competing continuation. So that means that our initial 5-year project period is lapsing in on September 29th. We can apply for one additional 5-year project period. And that's the limit for DFC funding for coalitions, 10 years. So when we do our competing continuation, which we're doing right now, we're basically thrown back into a pool of all other coalitions that have finished their 5 years and are reapplying for their last 5. So it's come up a couple of times. Some people have asked about, you know, are the peer reviewers who review this application, do they see the work that we've done? Do they see the progress reports that we've submitted twice a year for the past 4 years? And the answer is no. Unfortunately, we're just, and I think, you know, it's important to note that there are so many changes that coalitions go through over these past five years that it does make sense to just sort of put that all aside and explain kind of why we are deserving or why we are in need of this additional five years of funding. So with the project narrative, it's broken into five different components. So in the background section, we're basically talking about our area and what our need is. So the background is really, we're talking about what our risk factors are. Our risk factors that we focus on in Madison and Chatham are access, and then the sort of this community norm of adults favoring alcohol use. So that speaks to parent perception, low risk of parent perception, and then also our 30-day past use numbers as well with access. So those are the things that we really focus on the most in this application. In our background, we use a lot of our key informant data. We use our core measure data from 2019 and 2021. We use our listening session data from teens. We also use anecdotal information from coalition meetings. You know, we've, over the past 4 years, we've heard a lot, you know, people have shared a lot at coalition meetings that sometimes doesn't, you know, we don't think too much of it, but it just, you know, it feeds right into these risk factors that are contributing to underage substance use. So we also use that data as well. So the background is, you know, it's worth a lot. It's worth about 25 points. Of the project narrative. So that's, like I said, that's where we're talking about what the problem is. Then we move into our approach. The approach section is broken into four or five additional sections. So we talk about our purpose. So the purpose is, you know, really, again, what the coalition has done, just some of our highlights over the past 5 years, and then what we'll look to do as we move forward. So, you know, it's like a highlight reel. We talk about our podcast, we talk about our successful implementation of the survey at the middle schools and high schools. We talk about our collaboration with key sectors, you know, things like that. We also want to talk about the things that we're looking forward to doing in the next 5 years. So we really want to have a focus on addressing health disparities in Madison and Chatham, because health disparities, it's important for the CDC as well. It's something that's very important that we have to include in our application, but that we're addressing any health disparities that, you know, demographically that we're seeing. We also, from there, we move on to outcomes. So what are our objectives? What are we looking to do in 5 years? We want to see a decrease in 30-day past use. We want to see an increase in perception of parental disapproval. We want to see an increase in perception of peer disapproval. So, you know, those are, you know, they want to see SMART objectives. So we're clearly stating what our objectives are. And then from there, we move on to our strategies and activities. So specifically, what are we looking to do? You know, they want to see a comprehensive approach. So we want to be using our all seven strategies, you know, broken out into short-term, intermediate, and long-term outcomes, with obviously the long-term outcome being increased community collaboration and reduced substance use. By teens. From there, we move on to health disparities and target populations. And that's the section that, again, we're focusing on. You know, we as a coalition are focused on 12 to 18 year olds in Madison and Chatham. We give some demographic information about Madison and the Chathams. In that section in particular, we're highlighting the increase in the Asian population in the past several years, 6%, 7% increase. Since the last time we did this application. We're also focusing on non-English families. So again, that population is disproportionately affected by substance use. So we wanna highlight that. Also that ALIS income, so asset limited income constrained. Mars County has a significant ALIS income population. So Madison in particular has nearly 30% of the population. Wow. is out, yeah. So we're really highlighting that. We're pulling that data. It's very important that we're using that as well. It's been really interesting writing that portion in particular. You know, when I first started writing it, I was thinking, okay, this is worth 15 points, what are our health disparities? You know, we can see that Madison has a 9.6% Hispanic and Latino population. Chatham Township has exactly what it is. Let's see. Chatham Township has 19.8% of the population is Asian. These are significant numbers. So, and there, it's a change from the last time that we, that, you know, that we presented this data. So, but particular to the socioeconomic piece, that ALIS population is striking, especially when you look at the median income and house value in Chatham and Madison. So we want to make sure that we're addressing both ends of the spectrum, and then also that ALIS population in the middle. You know, what are we doing to ensure that these services and these programs and these strategies are reaching all populations in the community? So,
and could I just interrupt for 1 second? Sure. Because when you're talking about demographics like that, there is the economic portion of that demographic. But when you're talking about increased Asian American populations in areas, there's also a social aspect to that. And in many cases, Asians are practically invisible within communities, and they maintain a low profile because, as we've seen in the last, and this is just, we now have a diversity committee in Chatham Borough, just to reach out and provide community and support to individuals who have been forgotten and left aside or who are invisible. And I think that, I think that's an important consideration as well, as not just providing a social support because people have economic challenges, but providing a social support because people have social challenges and have been perceived and have been marginalized. And so that's another real stress factor, I think, and that is the marginalization of certain populations.
Thanks, Rosella. And we also, you know, it's interesting, those some key informant interviews that we've done with law enforcement and mental health clinicians highlight, two things. The hesitancy of some families to talk openly about substance use and mental health. And then also, in some cases, teens are, there's the language barrier, and teens are the ones that are translating for parents. And when teens are the ones that are translating for parents about issues related to their own mental health or substance use, that's a breakdown. That's a problem, you know? Yeah. So we want to make sure that we're doing everything that we can to learn about how we can support both parties and how we can work to bridge that gap.
Allison, do you have a sense of how the pandemic will play into the analysis and the how the information is received? I had an opportunity recently to chat with Joe Weber, the Board of Ed chair, and it was startling. And I don't even have to reference that conversation. Pretty much every conversation I have with a parent of a teen or a young adult, you know, they talk about the mental health issues that their child experienced. And you know, some stories are kids such a severe switch. They were excelling in school, very socially engaged, and now they've completely shut down, don't want to go back to school. So, and the numbers are dramatic as well. So while we like to show success, you know, the, and mental health has correlation to use, substance use, you know, you want to show success, but now we have the pandemic that's taken us way back in many respects. So I would hope just in that they would see value and continue to support the community. But I was just wondering, do you have a sense of how they're going to factor in that data?
Yeah, so there was a webinar a couple of weeks ago that the CDC hosted for coalitions that are in year 5 applying for year 6. And somebody did ask the question, how much should we be focusing on all what you're talking about? You know, there's the effects are, we're just starting to see the effects, and we will for several years to follow. And the CDC want, you know, obviously it's part of our narrative at this point for coalitions and for the population that we're trying to affect change in, but they don't want the whole application, of course, to be about COVID, because there are going to be specific grant programs that are going to focus just on that. What the CDC is looking for specifically, they're more focused on co-occurring disorders than SAMHSA was when SAMHSA was the funding agency. So they want us to be talking about adverse childhood experiences, trauma, as well as a risk factor for substance use. So we're including that where we can. But one of the things that we're highlighting, which I'm sure every other coalition is going to highlight as well, is the stress and anxiety that is a direct result of COVID for teens. So, and you know, those, that stress and anxiety level increasing in teens is then leading to substance use, of course. So that's kind of the way that we're weaving it in. You know, it's throughout the narrative here and there. It's, we're just trying to be delicate about how much we're focusing on it. I mean, but then again, when we do our progress reports twice a year, I feel like that's what we are talking about the most as a barrier for what we've been able to do. You know, New Jersey also, we were in lockdown for a lot longer than a lot of other states. And we all had the same amount of funding. We all had the exact same, there's 700 coalitions, over 700 coalitions in the United States right now. We all had the same expectations of what we were supposed to accomplish. You know, there weren't too many, there wasn't much leniency in anything, really. We still had to meet our match requirement. We still had to meet as much of our action plan goals as possible. So it's, we're definitely including it. And like I said, as a stress, as a risk factor for substance use through the levels, the increase in stress and anxiety. You know, but I think too, there's another section that we talk about collaborations. I don't know if I mentioned that before. So in the collaboration section, we're talking specifically about which other agencies in the community we're working with. You know, we highlight the, and also what we're going to, you know, the groups that we're going to focus on as we move forward. So we talk about the Chatham Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Group. We talk about Madison Housing Authority, which we have never really worked with in the past, but just going through and looking at the RDP housing and, you know, going down that rabbit hole of looking at that data. It's important that we're engaging groups that we have not engaged in the past. So Project Community Pride as well, particularly when we talk about ACEs and trauma as a risk factor for underage substance use. So more than COVID, we're trying to weave in this, just the mental health component as much as possible, it seems to be, and health disparities. They're very interested in how coalitions are addressing health disparities. So it's really interesting, like writing this, you know, the past 14 pages of this. So I write a section and then we go back and forth with Epiphany, who has just been great in providing, you know, a lot of feedback on the formatting and, you know, the content. I thought that the target populations and health disparities section was by far the had the least case for support. I thought that it wasn't strong at all. And she thought that it was the most interesting, you know, it has the most interesting detail or data, I should say, and that it really does paint a picture of towns, communities that do need support to address these gaps. So
when it comes to kind of the economic disparity component, I mean, certainly, you know, I remember way back when we did a book club, Price of Privilege, and it kind of talked about how you know, wealthy communities were experiencing the same rate of mental health issues, substance use, those types of things as, you know, communities that were either economically disadvantaged or dealing with other stresses. So, you know, hopefully they'll take that into consideration. But if economic disparity helps your case, Chatham Township is certainly bringing on board in the next, you know, year, 2462, about 90 units. Sorry, I'm just trying to do fast math. 86 units of affordable housing. You know, and about 30% of those will be low income. They'll have moderate income and low income. So, you know, if you're trying to build a profile, we are expecting to bring in over the next through 2023, those units should start opening up and start getting populated.
It's also, it was very difficult. I don't know. It was very difficult for me to find specifics on the number, the current number of units available. And then sort of that like 5-year plan, I guess, or what, you know, what is supposed to be available within the next however many years. But the poverty rates in, so the poverty rate in Madison is 5.1% and Chatham Township is 2.8%. And then in Chatham Borough, it drops to 1.2%. So I was trying to find a correlation between the number of units available and the poverty rates. But trying to go at it that way, it looks like it's more, I don't want to say appealing, but the difference in the how high the household income is, the median household income is, and the home price in juxtaposition to the poverty rates, that seems to be a little bit more compelling. Especially when, you know, we talk about affluence as it's a unique local condition. You know, there are families that are gone, you know, to vacation homes. You know, kids are staying behind because of, athletic schedules during the summer that are mandatory, leaving homes, you know, unattended, I guess you could say. So that specifically can be a risk factor for substance use. But it's also interesting to note that there is an economic disparity between the three communities. So like I said before, you have the 5.1% poverty rate in Madison, and 1.2% in Chatham Borough. And we're addressing all three of these, you know, all three of these communities. It's not, go ahead, Rosa.
I would just venture to say that the availability of affordable housing impacts the poverty rate, and the fact that these units have not been available means that these people are not living within this particular borough. And Chatham Borough is coming up on, there is a new development coming up on River Road in Watchung that's just under construction right now. So it's probably not going to be available for habitation until probably 2023. And then there's another unit that's going to go up in Post Office Plaza. We've been discussing that for the last 5 years. And there still isn't a determination of what's actually going to go in there, but there just isn't. I mean, one of the biggest problems with young people in Chatham Borough is that they grow up in the borough, they'd like to stay here, but they can't afford to live here. And so the absence of these affordable housing now, I think, has a real impact. So we're going to see some changes in the borough also as we move forward with more affordable housing. It's a strangulation kind of effect.
Yeah. Stacey, there isn't a housing authority, right, in the township or in the borough. No. Is it a no?
No. No. We have there's a firm that we hire to manage kind of the whole process, but the data, you know, I could certainly the number of units is easy. It is the 86, but we do have estimates on how many people will come into those units. We have estimates on how many children will come from those units. So if that data helps, I can get you those numbers. Okay. And then the total number of, so if it's, we're bringing on 86 units, but there's like 4,700 households or something. So to give you a perspective on kind of, you know, just how many additional units overall. And plus we already have the 70 units over at Vernon Grove, but those are for sale units. They're affordable for sale units.
How many is that?
70.
You know, Madison has a housing authority, right, Allison?
Yep. Yeah. The other interesting data point that I did not mention before, Kenny Channon has been very helpful in, so obviously as a coalition, we are focused on marijuana and alcohol use, and then vaping as a vehicle for, or as a device used for marijuana. We also, the CDC and also SAMHSA want to see a focus on other substances as well. So we do include a portion where we talk about opioids and just prescription pain medication. And because of Kenny's position as, well, he was narcotics detective, now he's detective sergeant for Madison, but he's also involved in several task forces for the state of New Jersey, just with narcotics. He was able to pull some really interesting data related to overdoses in Madison and the Chathams, number of Narcan deployments, and then break it out by age as well. So we just got that data a couple of days ago. I haven't worked it into the application yet, but it's very interesting. You know, they want to see, we also talk about our collaborations with the municipal alliances, as the Municipal Alliance addresses the entire age range of the population. So in particular, in our collaboration section, we're talking about MAC and MASA as partners, as a way to engage the younger population so that we are, you know, they're getting this prevention information earlier. And then also, you know, just looking at the data that Kenny shared, you know, we do see, you know, prescription pain medication, opioid abuse, but in that 18 to 25 age range. And the data that he shared supports that by far, you know, far and away, it supports that notion that that 18 to 30 year old range is where we're seeing a lot of Narcan deployments, a lot of overdoses. And his data also, overdoses is not just opioids. It includes adverse reactions to marijuana, lots of different things. So it's just, the reason I'm bringing this up is everybody has, you know, whether it's been through a key informant interview, whether it's been pulling a specific piece of data, school enrollment data, everyone has played such a valuable role in this process so far in gathering all of this data to really make our application be as strong as it can be, just with, you know, the different things that we have to include. So, you know, it goes to show why it's so important we have 12 sectors engaged. And if somebody is feeling like, oh, you know, I haven't gone to a meeting in a while, or I don't see that sector too much, literally everybody has played a really important role in this. So thank you to everybody that's on this call, but also that's why I'm talking about the people that aren't here, because, and at the county level, I should say, and then also at the municipality level, as well. So everyone has really, been crucial in kind of getting to where we are right now. So,
and I would also say, Allison, that when you're talking about extremely affluent communities and you're talking about the pressure on young people, particularly to play sports, because sports are seen as a an entrance ramp into particular colleges and universities, that includes a stress level. So I would think that you would have to include statistics about opioid use, particularly as pain medication, for these young people. I mean, every community has stresses. The stressors may be different from community to community, but that doesn't mean that there's a lack of stress.
Mm-hmm. And with the prescription medication in particular, it's access. That's another issue that, yeah, you know, that we want to address. So it's, you know, I don't think you could write an application for a drug-free communities grant without including, you know,
yeah,
opioids or prescription pain medication in some way. So just really quickly, the other two sections that we're working on we have to include an evaluation and data management plan, which Epiphany, as you all know, is our evaluator, our contracted evaluator. So they really help with that. That section primarily consists of what our data management plan looks like, what our indicators are, how we collect data, how we protect the integrity of the data that we collect, how we share the data that we collect, things like that. And then the last section is the organizational capacity. So what does our organizational capacity look like? What is our leadership team? How does the fiscal agent play a role in everything that we do? You know, their financial controls, what services did they provide to the coalition in terms of support? And then the last section is our action plan. So that's our year six action plan. So that whole thing is like the bulk of the application. And like I said, we're about 2/3 through that right now. The final draft to Epiphany is due March 28th, and then it's due to the CDC April 11th. In addition to all of that, we have the statutory eligibility requirements. So those are things, those are the first things that are reviewed. And if we don't meet some of those, any of those requirements, then we don't move on to peer review. So with the statutory eligibility requirements, a lot of it is the same of what we as what we had to submit in 2017, but we have to have our sector table. So we have to have our list of our sector representative, you know, for those of you that have signed a coalition involvement agreement, and then why, you know, what the rationale for selection is. We have to include a table that describes in detail what your, you know, what your connection is, what your role in the community is. We have to sign, you know, the Y has to sign several documents, you know, assuring that we're only applying for 10 years, that there's a 10-year funding limit. We have to provide a statement of legal eligibility showing that the Y is a 501c3 and they're applying on our behalf. There's a section where we have to include, we have to answer several general applicant questions, talking about the population, the demographic makeup of the communities that we're serving, our zip codes, things like that, the substances that we're focusing on. We have to also include resumes. So for myself and for the financial manager for the coalition, we have to include what else? A table of contents that numbers every single document that we're including. So it's, you know, those are the other pieces that, you know, they should be easy to get together. They take a lot. I feel like those take a little bit longer because you want to make sure that everything is just right. So, so we're getting there. It's, you know, unfortunately it's what is the focus, right? Not unfortunately, that is the focus right now. So coalition wise, we are a little bit quiet in terms of offerings and things like that. But that's not to say that in the next month, when this is over, we're going to just ramp right back up. Does anybody have any questions about the application, kind of where we are, any questions, any comments, anything that needing clarification on, anything like that before we move on? Go ahead, Rosal.
So, you sound like you're very on top of it, and I know it's not easy.
Yeah, you know, Marilyn, you were there, right? It's not fun. I wouldn't call it fun.
So this is a competitive grant, and this is, and we're in a pool with a whole lot of other people. What happens if we don't get it?
Well, if we don't get it, we have a lot of money in carryover from the past 5 years. So that could sustain us easily for at least one more year. And then we would reapply for a year, you know, we would use that lapse, that lapse in funding to strengthen our application further and apply again. But we, like I said, we do have, we have a significant amount of money in carryover. We could apply for what's called a no cost extension, which basically, you know, is allowing us to continue to accomplish the goals that we have not been able to accomplish over the past 5 years as a result of lots of things. The pandemic, my being on leave twice, you know, that there's money there for salaries. Also, we have a lot of money left over in carryover in the travel category because we haven't been conferences. We haven't been able to go anywhere. So, you know, there's money there as well. So, you know.
But the idea still is that over time, the community should be picking up the cost.
Yeah. Yep. That's a good point, Marilyn. Yeah.
I mean, so yeah. There is the direction is for not for them to be financing us forever, but for them to be giving us a foundation so that we can prove, you know, how valuable we are to the communities and they can then pick up the tab.
Yeah. Thanks for mentioning that, Marilyn. We also, as we advance year 7 and year 8, so our match requirement stays the same for year 6, it's 100%, $125,000. per year. When we move to year 7 and year 8, it goes to 125% of that. And then years 9 and 10, it's 150% of 125,000. So again, to reiterate what Marilyn is saying, the goal is to be fully sustainable by the end of those 10 years so that, you know, we've proven, Coalition has proven that it's an asset to the community and that it's necessary, but we, through the collaboration that we have through our community partners and our key stakeholders, you know, we're able to be fully sustainable without the DFC funding. So
what are the steps that we're taking then to put that those funds in position so that once the grant period is over, we will be sustainable?
Well, we year 4, we submitted a sustainability plan, and that you know, we talk about different ways that we can, you know, different intentions that we have within the community. So and that was for SAMHSA to show that we're at least thinking about it. We talk about partnering with the Y. One of the examples I'm thinking about is that we talked about partnering with the Y on their 5K run, and having some proceeds go to prevention programming for MCC. We talk about adding a donate now button on our website. We talk about a shared position with another agency in the community, either at the county level or the municipal level. You know, we don't currently receive any funding from any organization within the community. So to start putting those asks out, you know, in the next year, 2 years, you know, those are things that we'll have to start doing. We've also, year 3 is when a coalition, typically that's when that.
I just want to.
Go ahead, Marilyn.
I was just saying that's one of the reasons that it's important for us to continue to communicate through the different communities with the organizations that we look at as potential funding partners for what we're doing, so that they're really aware and we're not just coming out of, you know, left field.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You know, that's why the annual reports to the borough councils are important. And it's why, you know, presentations to Rotary and all these other things are important parts of this, the school.
Yep.
The Board of Education. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, obviously year 3 and year 4 and part of year 5, there's been obviously a pandemic that has greatly impacted
right.
the economy of, you know, of the entire community. So it hasn't been the best timing for anybody, but especially, you know, to go out and start asking, putting those asks out. So, you know, I think it's definitely something that we focus on, you know, in year 6, year 5, year 6, starting at, you know, starting this second half of this year, moving into year 6. And then we do have to submit another sustainability plan, I think next year, which just kind of builds on and sort of gives an update on where we are from the last one that we submitted. So,
I'm thinking that it wouldn't hurt to put the donate now button on the website, because just that builds, that starts to build the capacity. And the other thing that I would think about in terms of a sustainability plan is maybe creating a support network like Friends of MCC that would be dedicated to creating some fundraising events. I know we have things like Taste of Madison and, you know, that is a fundraising event for particular organizations. So as we move towards the end of the grant year, I mean, those structures should be being constructed now.
To the
fundraising structure. We should be talking about it across the course of the next couple of years, so that we already know the kinds of things we would want to do. Mm-hmm. And so when it's time for you to write the sustainability plan, you've got a couple of mechanisms already in the works.
I think the other thing to note is that because we haven't been able to spend money the way that we've intended to spend money for the past 3 years, it's hard to go out and ask for money and ask for support when we got it, you know, when we can't spend the money that we have, some of the money that we have, as a result of its environmental thing. Yeah. So that's been difficult, but I do, as we move into the next, the last part of our meeting, talking about our meeting structure moving forward, I would love to set up a sustainability committee for the coalition and really get that at, you know, have two different, I want, you know, in my mind, there's two distinct committees that we should be setting up. Sustainability is one, the other is data. So to have a specific data committee. So Marilyn can talk a lot about this, but the coalition had a great subcommittee structure for, you know, when the coalition was applying for the first round of funding, when it was under the mentor grant from McPick, there were committees, subcommittees like recruitment, youth recruitment, marijuana, alcohol, data, and everybody that was part of the coalition members were part of a different committee. And then each coalition meeting, people came together and then broke up into their subcommittees and had different tasks that they were focused on. And I think that probably, Marilyn, I'm sure it was very helpful with especially the grant application. Everyone kind of had their responsibilities. But do you want to, is there anything?
It also gave clarity to people about how they could participate. You know, what's been difficult during the pandemic, I think, is that there hasn't been an opportunity for people to really participate in something. And that's kind of really what people want to do. Mm-hmm. So the committees gave them a chance to say, this is the area that I'm interested in. This is what I'd like to do for this area. And so it was a way of really engaging the members of the coalition.
Maybe you can talk about this too. You know, our attendance fluctuates at meetings. Like the meeting we had last month, we had 20 people. This week, this meeting, we have far less than that. You know, how do you address what, you know, when you have 10 people in a meeting and five of them are on one of the four subcommittees, you know, that sort of becomes an issue for how those other committees can be productive, I guess, during that meeting. So I don't know if you ran into that a lot and how you addressed that in particular. And we can talk about that all together.
You know, there would be a program. So there's a program that involves everybody. And then you go to your committees and, you know, the committees have responsibilities. And as far as people being there or not, I think it was a reflection of how people felt about their responsibilities on the committees and how they felt about the program. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of important to have, you know, good programs. And then if they had actions that they were going to take in the committees, you know, I remember them showing up.
Right.
But if they didn't, whoever was the leader of that committee or task force would then do some minutes or, you know, do something to say, okay, this was done. And, you know, Joe Blow, how are you doing on XYZ? I didn't see you at the meeting.
Following up, yeah.
So to move forward and they could achieve their goals. Yeah.
So if we look at kind of what we want our meetings to look like going forward, you know, we're in, obviously, like I said before, the focus right now is getting this grant application written, you know, submitted. But when we go to April, our meeting will be in person, hopefully. And I, you know, I think that we should talk about, you know, trying to have some subcommittee meetings, some, you know, breakout sessions within the meeting. So if we look at the different types of subcommittees that we've had in the past and what we might want to have going forward, does anyone have any input on what types, you know, what specific types of subcommittees we should have? I think sustainability is important, so I want to make that one for sure. Does anybody else have any particular groups that we can name that we want to include?
Well, I think you always have to have an outreach for membership. So there has to be some sort of a, I'd say a membership outreach committee for each of the different, that should involve people from multiple sectors. Because not only do we want to reach out to youth and families that have youth, but we also want to reach out to other, to within the sectors of the coalition to maintain a relationship in each sector.
Okay, great. Yeah, I agree with that. Recruitment / membership outreach.
Yeah.
And you have to realize that people might be on a committee, but it can't always come on a 9:30. So you're always going to have people that I would even say are active people that you're never going to see at a meeting. But if you ask them to do something or you kept them informed, then they would, yeah, you know, do their bit, but you're never going to see them at a meeting.
Right. Yep. That's a good point too.
Or very rarely.
I would ask you to maintain some sort of a hybrid relationship, because I do think, just as Marilyn said, there are people who may not be able to travel to a particular meeting, but still might want to be involved and drop in some way. And since the schools all set up this kind of learning experience, I think a lot of people have experience with a hybrid situation.
Yeah, I agree with that. So recruitment, sustainability, and then what about just program or planning, just in general, initiative planning, something like that? You know, do we think that is, I think there also used to be a marketing subcommittee, I'm remembering as well. But that seems like a pretty broad just program planning in general seems like.
I think your program planning is, because you have quite a few programs that have been successful that have already been scheduled across the year. I think that program planning is sort of really way too big, that there should be a specificity with it.
We've also done like ad hoc committees focused on one particular event at a time, or one program or one presentation.
And those can be very effective, because people are, if they know what's expected and they kind of know what the time commitment it is and everything, they're much more likely to sign up.
So based on those, sustainability, recruitment / membership outreach, and then ad hoc for, you know, if we have two events going on, we would have two ad hoc committees. Just based on those, those of you that are on this call right now, do you feel like there's a subcommittee that you would feel compelled to be a part of, or do you feel like you're not sure where you would fit?
I'd have to think about it. I'd have to get something and then think about it.
Okay. So I will, probably write up some, you know, I'll send a separate MailChimp, probably not next week, the following week, talking about when I send out the information for our next meeting, you know, just information about these subcommittees, and that we're asking that everyone chooses one to be a part of, and that's kind of going to be our structure.
And I would also ask, when you send it out, is there something else that you would like to do that's not on here? You know, this was what we thought, but if there's another area that you're interested in.
Yeah. Okay, great. Okay, lastly, location. Does anybody have an idea for a meeting location for April, for our first meeting back in person, that we might reach out to try to? We could, the teen center is an option. In Madison, that's an option. Rose Hall. We've been there a couple of times.
No, I like the teen center.
Kathy, the teen center would be an option, right?
I like the teen center. Yeah. Yeah, depending.
Okay. I mean, I would like to try to do Chatham, Madison, Chatham, you know, as much as possible.
And the library has meeting rooms, and we also have a new, the Stanley Church Building Center. I don't know if it will be available. They had some HVAC and issues. And so they weren't really opening up to the public yet, but going down the road, there's the Stanley Center, which has a lot of meeting rooms. And then the library has some really nice meeting rooms also that just have, can be scheduled on their calendars.
Okay, perfect. Those are good suggestions. Maybe just to keep things, make things as easy as possible, we'll say the Teen Center for the
I would also say, the library of the Chathams has a really interesting camera speaker device that you can put into a room so that it, because we did that with the League of Women Voters. We did a holiday party that was both, that was hybrid, and they set up this owl camera, and you just put it on a table, and it actually captured the entire room on a screen so that people who were watching were part of the action, and the moderator did not, the person who was conducting the meetings didn't have to do a single thing. The camera was plugged in and it just did. And so you didn't have to sit in front of a computer. You could walk around. It was really a fantastic experience. And once we figured out that we didn't have to sit beside it and be dedicated to it, everything flowed a whole lot flexibly and easily.
Yeah, that sounds good. I wonder if other meeting spaces in Madison and Chatham have that. That would be nice to not have to walk around with a camera or a phone recording everybody. But we will, you know, I'll talk to the IT director here at the Y to see, you know, what we can do in terms of offering a hybrid option. Kathy, is the board offering hybrid? Or is it just in person or virtual?
I think they're looking at offering hybrid. I think the next meeting is, I think it's going to be in person. I can find out though, and we can see about what, technology we have to be able to offer hybrid and where, because we might even be able to do that in the Hubbard conference room.
Right.
So, yeah.
Okay.
So tell them about the owl camera. Tell your IT people about the owl camera.
Okay.
So we'll shoot for the Y, either Hubbard or the Teen Center for our April 15th meeting. Just a couple other updates, not many, but we are scheduled for Pat Awesome, who is a writer for contributor to Partnership to End Addiction. She's spoken at a consortium event for Chatham in the past. She is going to be doing a presentation for us on April 21st at 7 p.m. Called Driving Through the Fog. So focusing on the impact of marijuana on driving, and just kind of giving an overview of how
its availability, yeah,
how impairment is affected, driving is impaired by marijuana. So April 21st at 7 p.m. It's going to be virtual, just an online presentation, but it's live. And then we are still finalizing the details for a presentation with Conrad Annie. I think that's how you pronounce his last name. He is a crisis clinician with Atlantic Health. He's going to be talking about adolescent brain development and the impact of alcohol. So we're finalizing those dates as well. Does anybody have anything else that they want to add or bring up before we wrap things up? All right. Well, thank you all.
Sounds good. Thank you, Allison.
Great. Thanks everyone so much for joining me. And look out for that email probably the week after next about our next meeting and our subcommittees in person. Thank you.
Thank you, Allison.
Thank you. I just want to say that your newsletters and the Constant Contact continue to be creative, entertaining, and useful. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for reading.
Have a great day, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.